This is The Loving Project, a podcast celebrating the 50th anniversary of Loving v. Virginia, the 1967 Supreme Court ruling that overturned state laws banning marriage between people of different races.
In each episode, we share the story of a different interracial couple. This time we hear from Jean and Moss, a couple who met and started dating just a few years after the Supreme Court ruling. At the time, they were both working at an organization involved with civil rights and social justice issues.
My name is Jean, and I'm white.
My name is Moss. I'm Japanese American.
And we've been together since 1972 for 45 years. We got married in 1992, 25 years ago. We have two adult children, Michiko and Kenzo, and we have three granddaughters.
We were both on committees with the American Friends Service Committee here in Philadelphia. Friends Service Committee is an organization that was founded in 1917, originally to provide a means by which men who would not take up arms during the First World War, it provided an outlet for doing service in some forms of conscientious objection. And it developed over the years into doing other types of service work, particularly dealing with relief work in war-torn Europe. I initially had gotten involved working as a summer volunteer in the first efforts on the war on poverty in the mid-60s.
And I worked there. I dropped out of college here in Philadelphia in 1965, and I got a job as a secretary there. Worked in an international division where there were programs in Vietnam, in Hong Kong, in Africa, West Africa, in Europe. They were doing amazing programming all over the world. So we met in the late 60s.
Probably 69.
69. But I was a brand new feminist, and I wasn't too interested in men. And we really connected when we were both on a working party for the American Friends Service Committee. And we both saw the world very much through the perspective of the fight for justice, a very active fight, not a passive fight. And in that working party, I found myself very drawn to Moss by the things that he had to say. He was very feminist and very appealing.
Jean was probably the most articulate. I wouldn't even say the most articulate woman. She was just about the most articulate person, peer, that I can recall, speaking about women's issues, but more broadly as well. And she was very poised, obviously very smart. I found her very attractive. And it's clear we were simpatico. It was also clear that she operated at a different emotional tempo than I did.
Very. Very.
So in that sense, I mean, it was differences attract as well as similarities. I'm Japanese American, as noted, and there were cultural differences. I mean, speaking out directly is not exactly something that was prized in the culture. It's more of, you know, I wouldn't say exactly suppressed emotion, but downplayed emotion and indirection in terms of what you say to people. So in that sense, we were quite different. I think Jean has a tendency to speak directly from how she's feeling, and I don't.
I was raised in a mother was Jewish, not religious, but a very political Jewish family. My father was an ex-Irish Catholic. You talked a lot in my family. You talked about everything. You talked about if you were mad, if you were sad, you talked about everything. My brother and sister and I did that as well. So I would say the early struggles, which were about race, but they were really about culture, were around this difference in how you worked things out. When Moss's mother died many, many years later, she died in 2011. He gave this incredibly moving speech about her at her service. And I sat there thinking she never once said to him, "I love you." She never once said it. But he knew it. He just knew it. Whereas in my family, we said it, you know, all the time. And it's the difference between how those things are expressed. And there was has been over the years a lot of tension about that. I think that that's been one of the hardest things for us because I yearn for it. And for him, it shuts him down. He looks like a deer caught in headlights, you know, when you start to say, "Well, how do you feel about that?" Yeah. It's not where he goes.
Yeah, more like a deer gunned down.
Yeah, right, right.
Not just in headlights.
Japanese people don't believe in public displays of affection at all. So we would have these struggles on the street where I'd want to hold hands and he'd do it for like four steps and then he'd be like, drop the hand. And when we went to his house, especially in the beginning and I didn't know his family, the thing that would make me comfortable would be to sit right next to him and be able to touch him and stuff. And he'd be like, you know, trying to get away. And then I saw the movie, I think it's The Namesake. It's a movie about an Indian family. And in the story, the guy brings home a white girlfriend and she's always touching him and she tries to hug his parents. And it's just like the worst thing she could ever do. And I was like, oh, that's what I was doing. I began to realize it sooner, but that movie really cemented it for me. And his family was so sweet that toward the end, they would kiss me when I came, but it wasn't really what they were comfortable doing. And he doesn't really want to be hugged. Even good friends, he doesn't want to be hugged. I feel like we ought to have a little sign. Mus really prefers not to be hugged.
Well, it is an interesting, a lot of people that see it as important to hug as a symbol of friendship. And I've never felt terribly comfortable with that. I mean, so some, with some people, I just say, look, don't hug me, I'm Japanese, you know? It's like that, no sex, please, I'm British.
I mean, Mus has smoothed my edges down quite a bit. And I'm very grateful for it because, you know, I think that for somebody like me, learning to listen, like learning to wait and just not jump in, it's very hard for me. In my house, there was a sort of abruptness to the way we did things. And I remember once our daughter, Michi, said something to Mus about, why is she like that? Why does she talk that way? And I heard Mus say, she doesn't really mean it. And I didn't really mean it. And I didn't really know I was doing it. You know, it's the way it is in your house. That's just the way it is. I didn't realize that it had a harshness to it. So I think he's smoothed me down and I've speeded him up.
Yeah, or pushed me, I think, positively on things. I mean, I don't always appreciate the pace of it or necessarily sometimes the tone of it, but it's something that has been helpful to me. We help each other out in that regard.
A lot, a lot.
The community I grew up in is in Seabrook, New Jersey, which is just outside of Bridgeton. The center of it was a frozen food plant in which Japanese Americans had been interned during the Second World War. A significant number of them were offered jobs there and housing. So that's, I grew up in that community. So there was a sense of solidarity as a group of people who shared a condition. I mean, you know, race and had the same basic history. You know, we were the kids of parents who had been interned and you know, we'd also been through the Depression and the war and the process of relocation. My parents were both interned. They actually met in an internment camp in Poston, Arizona. So I was the product, if you will, of their meeting and getting married in camp. And I find that one of the great ironies of it all, you know, because there's no anti-Asian racism, no World War II, there's no me. You know, I mean, I was part of a generation of people that were born in the camps. So they got married in 1942, which was the year that the camps opened. They moved to Arkansas, and I think we were there for about 2 years. And then from there, they moved to Seabrook, New Jersey, where they found employment at Seabrook Farms.
But an interesting difference between us was that I always say that Mus had the most secure childhood of anybody that I know, any of my friends. He grew up in a community where people were close by, there was family, it was poor, it was very secure. I felt very insecure. I had this Jewish socialist mother. My father was, we didn't quite fit in at, what are you? Are you Christian? Are you Jewish? What are you? Well, we're not really either. We're social. I mean, it was just, I didn't feel secure. So in an odd way, this person who comes through one of the more racist incidents in the history of this country. And I think partly because of that, the adults in that community were determined that the children were going to feel safe.
I think there was things that became clearer in looking back. I think a feeling that at least non-intimidation by white people, about white people. My objective experience was, you know, I thought from elementary school and high school, whites were clearly overrated. You know, I mean, they weren't smarter than we were, and they weren't better athletes than we were.
And they weren't better looking than you were.
So, hey, what's the big deal?
But it also meant that when there was a racial incident at our daughter's school, when she was little, she went to the local public school. And she was upset, and I didn't know why she was upset. And finally she said, well, people are pulling my ponytails, and they're calling me Ching Ching Chinaman. And when you're a white parent, this isn't an experience you've had. So you're like, how could this possibly be? How could anybody do this to my child? And Moss didn't really have a response.
Well, it's out of my experience, too. Nobody ever called me a Jap or a Nip or a Gook or... I mean, I'm sure that happened when the Japanese Americans first settled in the area that I lived in. But it never happened to me. I mean, I knew what that meant, but I had no direct encounters in that same way.
But it was interesting because her teacher at school handled it beautifully.
Yeah.
And found the kids that were doing it and sat them down and said, does anybody tease you at home? And they said, yeah, you know, my cousin teases me. Well, how do you feel about it? I hate it. Well, you're going to take care of Michi on the playground. And they did. And it stopped. But it was an interesting experience because I remember I turned to him like, oh, what do we do about this? But it wasn't in either of our experiences. We were both kind of lucky that way. Michi dove into being Japanese American way more than Kenzo did. So Moss had his mom, Mama, and then he had two sisters, Reiko and Isako. And, you know, they used to dress her in kimono for the chow mein supper. And Reiko got her a job at the Japanese house when she was in eighth grade, and she led tours there for the whole summer. And she just had a lot more experiences than Kenzo did. And she welcomed it more. And then when the internet became available, she started trolling the internet to find Hapas, kids that are half and half. And she found magazines that Hapas were writing, and she found all these resources that she brought to us. Kenzo didn't so much. I think Kenzo really wanted, first of all, Kenzo's last name is Nakawataze. That's his dad's name. Michi's last name is Hunt. We agreed when I was pregnant the first time that if it was a girl, she'd have my last name and his is the middle. And if it was a boy, we would flip it. So he's Hunt Nakawataze and she's Nakawataze Hunt. And she's like, why did you do that? The dentist doesn't know we're brothers and sisters. It really bothered them. And that's an unintended consequence that I had not thought of. But anyway, he was going through his life named Kenzo Nakawataze. She was going through her life named Michi Hunt. Kenzo Nakawataze is a much harder name to have. People mangle it. They can't spell it. They make fun of it. They don't know what. I mean, people make fun of everybody's names, you know.
I make fun of her name, for example.
They all make fun of my name.
It's so short.
I just have a little short name, and they all have these long names. But anyway, I think he was trying to fit in. That's my sense of it. I think he's much more interested now.
He's much more political generally. I mean, you know, he's...
Right. He's married to an African-American woman. They have this little girl, so she's got an African-American grandpa and a Japanese-American grandpa and this Irish grandma and this Irish-Jewish grandma. She's like, who is she? You know, it's kind of like she's American. But I think as a younger person, I think for him, he was really just trying to make it through the day and not have anybody hassle him. That's my sense.
I think in fairness, too, they probably caught onto some contradictions just in me, you know, that... Growing up, I didn't know Japanese, and you make a decision, at least I'm speaking for myself here, whether or not you really dive in terms of assimilation. You know, there was a Japanese school, for example, language school. I didn't go there. Some of my friends did. I mean, I regret it, but there it was. You know, it's a different choice to make in the 50s than it is now. But I think if you're coming out of the Second World War and you're Asian, you're thinking, well, you're not, I mean, all the things I just said previously still apply about being raised in this community. But there was also the sense that, you know, you wanted to jump into the American culture. I consider myself a child of the 60s, but we were also raised in the 50s, you know, and just like everybody else, we were watching shows like Father Knows Best and Ozzie and Harriet and I Love Lucy. And there was this drive towards normality, whatever that is, you know. It's strange. I mean, we're physically visible and conspicuous, but not to be so conspicuous that you seem out of sorts or different in that sense. I mean, in cultural terms. You didn't draw attention to yourself. You weren't pushing yourself out there. I mean, you sort of, you know, obeyed social norms, kind of just behaved yourself. You know, you didn't want to dishonor your family. I think our families in the community wanted their kids to be as normal, as, quote, as American as they could be.
And as safe as they could be. They were pretty traumatized. I mean, their lives were very, very, very hard. His mother had a really, really rough time. And when I was pregnant with Michi, I said, I'd like to name the baby after you. And she said, please don't do that. I've had such bad luck in my life. I'm afraid it would bring bad luck to her. That's a pretty powerful statement. And that trauma, they just pulled up their socks and buttoned up their shirts and got on with it. Our parents were completely 100% supportive. I think even back then, it was much easier to be white and Asian than to be white and black. I mean, just think, you know, you weren't subjected to the same social forces, to the same kind of racism that we would have been if one of us had been black and one of us had been white. I mean, my mother loved Moss from the minute she met him. And my dad loved him too. And his dad, I only met his dad one time. His dad died not that long after we got together. I didn't sense from him any hostility at all toward me because I was white. And his mother was always wonderful to me. Early in our relationship, we saw Breakfast at Tiffany's, or we each saw it separately. And Moss hated it because of the Mickey Rooney character is an Asian and he's ridiculous. And I didn't notice it when I watched the movie. So I think for me, what's happened over the years is this deeper understanding of my whiteness and the privilege that I have to stand in the feet that I stand in and see things. And that's really been increasing with the Black Lives Matter movement and the right wing and understanding that this core dynamic in the society is deep and has to be opposed. I don't feel it in our relationship. I just feel it in our world and the world that my children and grandchildren are going to have to face. And I think my own understanding has deepened as the years have gone on. When I first became politicized, I thought back to my high school. I went to a big public high school in Rochester, New York, and realized all the black kids in my school were in the basement because they were all tracked into the vocational. None of them were upstairs in the classrooms upstairs. I didn't notice, because that's just the way it was. So when you're white, it's like you have to wake up. But I don't feel like between us, I don't know, I just don't feel like race is a big issue between us that causes friction. And we have other things that cause friction.
Yeah. I remind Jean that she's outnumbered.
They call me a Hago Jean. In my own family, they call me a Hago Jean.
Well, that just means white on occasion.
They got me a t-shirt that says in Japanese, Hago Jean.
But I actually think that all the ensuing social struggles have probably strengthened the relationship. I mean, we're clearer about what we believe and what we do about things or don't do about things. Over the years, I think that's solidified the relationship. I mean, I'm trying to think of whether we've had any major or even minor disagreements.
We haven't been treated harshly by the world for being together. We have not.
Yeah.
So we haven't had to cope with that. We've been very, very lucky that way. And I think that we had so many, what I described as cultural issues about the differences in the ways that we were raised. But the things that have bound us together, our children have really bound us together and solidified our understanding of our commitment to each other and our commitment to the world. And the grandchildren have done that even more. And our political work, we've always been talking about it all these years, but we've just gotten closer. When we got together in 1972, I was deeply involved in the women's movement in Philadelphia. There was a women's center in Philadelphia. I lived there and I worked in a staff collective. And I answered the phones at night, and we would get calls at night from women saying, I'm trying to leave the house, but I have no access to my money. Or, he's beating me and I have nowhere to go. Or, I don't have a credit history. Or, there were all these things. I knew Moss was never going to beat me. I knew I trusted Moss with my life. But the marriage contract at that time was a contract in which two people merged into one person, and that one person was him. You didn't exist. The woman didn't exist. She had no independent standing anywhere in the world, and it just didn't seem like a reasonable contract to enter into. Why would you do that? So after 20 years, you know, things had changed quite a bit. We were going to celebrate our 20th anniversary, and it became clear to me that Moss had really hoped to get married all along, and I wasn't unhappy about doing it.
I'm a bourgeois at heart.
I wasn't unhappy about it. So we had a great party because nobody was nervous about whether this was going to work or not. And the kids were there and we had a great party and we got married. And it didn't feel that different to be married at that point. But the legal arrangement had altered because of the fight of women to change it.
The Loewing decision was an important advance. It was a major step forward. The cautionary note is that no victories are permanent. And we live in times that would suggest that it's important to remember the advances, but also the needed vigilance to sustain those victories.
When I think about the 50th anniversary and the differences between 1967 and 2017, I'm very happy people can marry who they want in all kinds of ways. Gay people, straight people, everybody, whatever race. And as I look at my multiracial grandchildren, I want them to be able to go where they want to go with love. At the same time, Virginia is the state where people ran through the streets with torches just recently, chanting slogans, Nazi slogans and Ku Klux Klan slogans, and ran over a woman and killed her. So we have a mixed reality that we are living in 50 years later.
I was at a reception in downtown Atlanta in December of 1963. I was there with a group from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, as it was then called. The group was numbered around maybe 15 people altogether, male and female, black and one Asian American. And after the reception, we were at a diner that wouldn't serve us. And so we all got arrested and put in jail for criminal trespass. And they divided it by gender. So, I don't know, three or four white women and six black, and a group of men, everybody black except me. So when I, obviously I, you know, I wanted to go with the guys that I had been arrested with. And I was saying to the jailer, you know, hey, look, put me with them. You know, then he looked at me and he said, but you're not colored, you know? I mean, colored meaning black. So then you're white. I mean, you know, it was like, yeah, sure. You know, I mean, and I think about that as just, you know, racism is vicious and stupid and all that, but it's also ridiculous. You know, that's the only thing you could come out of that experience saying, you know, it made no sense. So I spent, you know, a couple nights in jail by myself, but that explanation kind of said everything and nothing at the same time.
I think the blindness that comes with whiteness is a big part of racism. I mean, I don't think all these people that say racist things, I don't think they're all evil. I think that they haven't had that experience that strips that veil off your face. And it has to be stripped off over and over again. You know, you have to unlearn it and unlearn it and unlearn it. So, and Michi's helped me a lot with that because she's reading constantly and talking about these issues constantly. And I'll say, well, don't you think that thing that somebody in Black Lives Matter said was a little too much? She's like, no, not at all. You know, and I'm like, right, you're right. Gotta, you know, go back, strip it off. So I guess that's the process that you have to go through as a white person.
Racism is not immutable. It's deep, but it also is a condition that people struggle against with some degree of, I wouldn't call it exactly success, but some advance. You know, things do change. People's opinions change. People change. So I don't despair because, you know, we see it all around us. It is a series of things that have to be learned, as Gene says, over and over again. But people are willing to do it. And I think that's an important lesson. People don't give up, which is good. Because
we're not giving up. We're holding on to hope.
We'd like to thank Gene and Moss for sharing their story.
The Loving Project's available in iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and NPR One. And if you like the show, please consider leaving a review.
You can also find out more about the podcast at our website, lovingproject.com, where there are also pictures of some of the couples profiled on the show, more episodes, and links to follow us on social media. I'm Farrah Parks.
And I'm Brad Linder. Thanks for listening to The Loving Project. In the next episode of The Loving Project, we'll hear from Jen and Ermias. Jen is white, and Ermias is black and Eritrean.
They met in 1995 when Jen was in the Peace Corps and working as a teacher in Eritrea. But it wasn't until a decade later that the Eritrean government allowed Ermias to leave the country and come to the United States.
Many people thought actually our problem was the U.S. Embassy.
Oh,
because
yeah.
In most countries, it's the U.S. Embassy. Your country says, we don't care.
Yeah, one of my huge frustrations through that whole time period was when I would come back to the U.S. and people would ask me, like, what's going on? Why isn't your husband here yet? And I would say, the Eritrean government still won't give me the exit visa. And people just wouldn't hear me. They'd be like, oh, it's such a shame that U.S. immigration is so difficult. And I would repeat myself to the same people again and again. But people just couldn't grasp that we're the only country that has the power to limit people's movement, that other countries get to do that, too.
Ermias and Jen's story. Coming up next time on The Loving Project.